This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us today. Our topic of the episode is age-related macular degeneration, and I am delighted to have two super smart, important people who, in some respect, have spent and continue to spend a lot of their time in this focus. I have Dr. Chris Putnam and Dr. Jessica Haynes. Dr. Putnam, you know, I'm going to let him elaborate, but part, if not a lot of his PhD was focused in this endeavor, at least towards a portion of how we take care of some of these patients. And Dr. Jessica Haynes sees patients and works for what could really be one of the most famous retina practices in the entire world. And so super excited to talk about this topic, which I think affects pretty much all ECPs in the world today. So if you don't mind, Jessica, would you mind just elaborating on what I said and tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having us on today. This is a great topic, as you said, something everyone can really benefit from. As Chris said, I work primarily in a retina specialty clinic. And in that clinic setting, we are just dealing with patients who have retina disease. We're seeing primarily patients who have advanced stage macular degeneration, and of course, mostly patients who are receiving anti-VEGF injections or patients who have exudative AMD. But we do also follow patients who have early intermediate AMD and even those who have advanced stage non-exudative AMD. In addition to that, we do participate in some clinical trials, both for non-exudative and exudative advanced forms of macular degeneration. But most of the patients that I'm encountering on a daily basis are these more advanced stage patients.
Yep, makes perfect sense. Dr. Putnam, Chris, how about you? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Absolutely. So greetings, everyone. So my name is Chris Putnam. My primary mode of practice is I'm an active duty optometrist. So I see typically the 18-year-old healthy all the way up to the 95-year-old retiree that's not quite as healthy. In my spare time, I'm also a faculty member at the University of Incarnate Word, Rosenberg School of Optometry. And in that role, I have a little bit more flexibility on working with students, working with residents, and utilizing some of the newest technologies that we can, I think, move towards a direction of a subclinical diagnosis. And I think as we have a chance to chat today, I think it's the subclinical diagnoses and some of that identifying early risk factors and early features of AMD that are otherwise missed on a routine dilated fundus exam. So I'm very excited to hear from Jessica on what she does on the NIH or the trial basis, because that's something that I have not worked on in a while. Dr. Levens mentioned that some of my PhD work was primarily in AMD, but mostly it was associated with macular pigment and some of the visual function that goes along with that. So spatial distribution, some of the contrast sensitivity, glare disability, and photostress recovery that comes along with that. So I'm actually very excited to be part of today's panel.
Awesome. Glad to have you both. So to me, the easiest place to start is at the beginning. And when we talk about, is this a big deal or not? And is it getting to be a bigger deal over the course of time? So as we look at prevalence of AMD, you know, depending on what resource you pull from, the stats that I know are ballpark 10% of people over age 65, more than 25% of people over age 75, 2 million with advanced AMD in the US, over 8 million with an intermediate form. But what's startling is these numbers have been doubling every few years. In fact, they almost doubled in 2020. And so where is this accurate in terms of what we're seeing in practice? And is this trend going to continue, or is it going to plateau?
So, yeah, Chris, I mean, AMD is definitely a huge issue, especially with our aging population. And, you know, it's very hard to fathom sometimes these percentages, these millions of patients. But, you know, one big thing to kind of keep in mind is macular degeneration still is the number one cause of vision loss in patients over the age of 65. So if you're over the age of 65, your biggest threat to your vision is macular degeneration. So if you think about that, I mean, that in itself makes this a really big problem.
Absolutely. And I think one of the more interesting things on the prevalence rates is there was a study that came out in 2016, 2017, and I believe it was published in JAMA Ophthalmology. And what they were looking at was prevalence of undiagnosed AMD in primary eye care. And I believe they looked at both primary care ophthalmology and primary care optometry. And they found that approximately 25% of eyes that were normal, deemed to be normal through DFE, in fact, did have intermediate drusen and large drusen treatable with our AREDS2 protocols. So I think it's just interesting that even with our current prevalence rates and even with the increase in the prevalence rates, I think as we become more attuned, more specific in our diagnostic capabilities, I think we're going to see those prevalence rates go up, because I do think that AMD is absolutely one of those eye conditions that as you celebrate birthdays, it becomes more and more likely you're going to have some early maculopathy associated with AMD.
So are you suggesting, Chris, that we might be having to intervene in patients before we the practitioners, see a visual change in the fundus?
I absolutely do. So some of the work I've done with University Incarnate Word, we've looked closely at clinical dark adaptometry and utilizing that as a feature of AMD. And I think the most important part about thinking of how the retinal physiology goes forward, when you're doing dark adaptometry, what you're essentially measuring is a little bit of RPE dysfunction, because what happens in dark adaptometry is that visual cycle becomes impaired. The vitamin A, the retinal transport across the RPE is just impaired. So you start to have this lack of sensitivity return. And, you know, certainly I have no stock. I own none of these companies. I'm just familiar with the one clinical device, AdaptDx. And really, we have had a lot of great success. And a lot of the literature points to the fact that if you start to identify dark adaptometry issues early, that is a precursor. In fact, it's been defined almost as a feature of early AMD. And I think if we start to really pour into the literature about pharmaceutical, nutraceutical, and some of these early lifestyle changes, I think we can start to change course on these prevalence numbers.
You are totally leading me to the next topic I was going to go after. But before I head there, sure. Jessica, you mentioned that in your practice, you're frequently targeting and seeing more advanced cases, though you did mention you do see some earlier to intermediate cases as well. But given the amount of volume of patients that are being referred to you, in all likelihood due to progression, do you employ any type of instrumentation that has a goal of early diagnosis?
So we actually don't have dark adaptometry in our practice. And a lot of that is because of the fact that we're not seeing these earlier stage patients quite as frequently. And typically, we're not going to get someone until at least they already have signs of AMD, like clinical signs, either on the fundus evaluation, on the OCT evaluation, or the fundus autofluorescence, or intermediate or advanced. But like Chris said, I mean, there's a huge need to identify these patients early on and to modify risk factors early on, because these patients who we see who are 80 years old and then get referred to us because they have choroidal neovascularization, or they get referred to us because they have geographic atrophy, they're not seeing well. And even though there's not a lot we can do for geographic atrophy, they kind of, I think folks want to send them out for that second opinion that, you know, this is all sort of that we can do. But when that patient's sitting in your chair and they're 80 years old, there's been 80 years of life. You know, how much risk modification could you have done in that 80 years prior? You know, even right. When the patient was perhaps was young and they were a smoker or something like that. So that person who's sitting there they may have a certain genetic makeup that predisposes them. They may have certain risk factors like age that you can't do anything about, but they may have a daughter or they may have a granddaughter who carries these same genetic factors, and you could talk to those patients about risk modification. So the reason it's so hard to treat geographic atrophy is because of the fact that this is a process that's been going on so long before you even see clinical signs and so long before you get to this point of having geographic atrophy. So if we could do something earlier on, would be more ideal.
Yeah, sadly, age is not a modifiable risk factor.
I totally exactly. get it.
In terms of the things that are, though, you mentioned smoking. Smoking for greater than 40 years, at least 2 to 4 times more likely to develop AMD. Fat intake, particularly saturated fats, omega-6 fatty acids, has a preponderance of risk, more additional risk for AMD. Are there any other modifiable risk factors that come to mind?
So I guess from my standpoint in a primary care setting, some of the modifiable risk factors for AMD, cardiovascular disease tends to have an association with AMD, and especially the exudative and more severe types of atrophic AMD. I think there's some emerging evidence that obesity and BMI also is a risk factor associated with development of AMD. And I think you already hit the nail on the head with the diet low in fruits and veggies. Really, if you can modify that diet early, I think the triad of good diet, good exercise, and good rest. In a few minutes, I'm sure we'll move on to the topic, but I love to talk about nutraceuticals and some of the supplementation mm-hmm. strategies. But I think nutraceuticals and supplementation strategies are just that. They're a supplement, not a replacement. So sometimes, unless you can work with that patient to really modify those risk factors, no matter how hard you work and the testing you give and the supplements you might recommend, without those modified risk factors, you're fighting an uphill battle.
Right. And, you know, a big thing about these risk factors, too, is they don't exist in isolation. So, you know, obesity, cardiovascular disease, diet, exercise, these things are all linked to one another. So there's no magic cure for this. It's a complicated cure that involves an overall healthy diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely. And so in the primary care realm, I get a lot of questions from patients that want to discuss genetic risk factors. So they've talked like, hey, my parents, my grandparents, my sister has been diagnosed with AMD, and I've been told there's a genetic link. And they always want to know about genetic tests, you know, 23andMe, any number of those genetic tests. And I'll always talk to them at length that, you know, there are 2 significant risk alleles. I know we can talk about CFH and ARMS2, but the number one thing that I always like to stress for the patients is, the risk allele is just that. It's a risk allele. So presence of the allele does not mean development of the disease. And conversely, absence of the disease allele doesn't mean that you're free and clear as well. So I always try to stress that if the patient is interested in doing genetic testing, I'll be more than happy to help with the interpretation. But I always try to steer them away from interpreting the results themselves, because I think that you can misconstrue what those 23andMe and what some of those home genetic tests will give you, because if you read through there, it can scare the heck out of you. You're suddenly positive for every risk factor out there, and you're like, oh my God, my life's coming to an end. And I think there's a psychological toll that can take on the patient.
Before we change topics, one of the things that's always I've been curious about is 2 of the largest population studies in eye care have been the Blue Mountain study and the Beaver Dam study. And a combined analysis from those 2 enormous cohorts suggested an increased risk of developing eventual late-stage AMD, especially neovascular AMD, in those that underwent cataract surgery. Is that just an anomaly in the research? Is there really something there? Was it more of an archaic method of this surgery that doesn't exist today? Or is there something real that we should be thinking about?
You know, that's a good question, Chris. Steve Charles, who I work with at Charles Retina Institute, I don't know exactly where he references this from, but he always states cataract surgery does not cause AMD. So I'll reference Steve Charles on that one.
Well, I mean, we obviously continue to have refer patients for cataract surgery, and we haven't stopped that, and we shouldn't stop that. And admittedly, sometimes the statistics are just the the statistics, and they can confound you despite what they suggest. But it definitely sticks out there like a sore thumb. And I've not heard anybody really, you know, elaborate or make some sense of why exactly the numbers came out that way.
Yes. And you could think of also like these risk factors for AMD are also somewhat risk factors for developing cataract formation, like sunlight exposure, you know, for example. So
sure.
Perhaps the need for cataract surgery at these younger ages just coincides with patients who have similar risk factors for macular degeneration as well. But I really don't know. That's just me speculating.
And I'm with Jessica on that. I think if I had to take a speculative jab at this, I think that some of the retinopathies as well as cataract development, a lot of these share the same kind of three things. So if we're looking at retinopathy and cataract development, oxidative stress, general inflammatory conditions, and mitochondrial dysfunction. And I think maybe an individual who's already predisposed to having a widespread inflammatory state and maybe widespread oxidative stress are more likely to develop cataracts and thereby have already set themselves up for a little bit more vulnerable retina, if you will, to developing late stage and exudative AMD.
Gotcha. All right. So before we dive into the clinical findings, testing, treatment, you know, with any disease state, it's at least wise to briefly cover what the pathophysiology of this condition is. You know, what initiates it and causes it at as close to cellular level as possible. So in your best layman's terms, you know, I think most people understand, well, there's some aberrant issue with the RPE, aberrant issue with the choriocapillaris, all leading towards this upregulation of VEGF. But how do you explain this to a colleague? How do you explain it to a student? How do you explain it to a patient about really what's going on in the layers of the retina that initiate this disease state?
So, you know, in regards to talking about this to patients, I do actually pull up their OCT images of their macula, and I point out the retina sort of on top, the neurosensory retina, the retinal pigment epithelium, and then the choroid. And as far as telling patients and how I explain it to them, I'll usually describe it as these drusen deposits that you see are accumulations of, and I don't typically say like cellular waste products, I might say something else to a patient, but you have these drusen depositions that occur. And for patients, I really try to hone in a lot on the fact of, you know, the idea of wet macular degeneration, because that's what we're really monitoring patients for. So I'll tell them that these drusen depositions weaken this layer that's a barrier between your retina on top and your choroid underneath. And this choroid underneath is filled with blood vessels. When this layer becomes weakened, these blood vessels can grow through and start to leak or bleed. So especially for patients, I really try to emphasize that particular aspect of it, because that's the big thing that we are actually monitoring them for. And that's why they have to use the Amsler grid and other types of monitoring devices.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect kind of counterpoint, because I think Jessica tends to see patients that are a little bit further along in their development. So she tends to see more of the intermediate late-stage AMD and then the exudative AMD. So from my standpoint, when I'm seeing patients in a primary care that have either high risk and no maculopathy or mild maculopathy with a threat to transition to intermediate, I usually talk about the two big driving forces are microvascular disruptions and insults and then RPE dysfunction. So every time I have a patient in my chair who's discussing their, you know, systemic diabetic control, their hypertensive control, or their dyslipidemia, I'll always take a special moment to like stop and say, you know, all of these three things are setting you up for progression to maculopathy, because those small microvascular changes, and I think when we talk about it in a moment, because this is what I'd love to talk about, I think OCTA is going to be a game changer. I really think that OCTA is going to show us things that we've never had the ability to image before, and I think it's going to show us that a lot of what we assume to be atrophic, in fact, has some very mild microvascular and neovascular changes. So I will always talk about microvascular changes, saying the better controlled your systemic diabetes, hypertension, and dyslipidemia is, the less risk factor you have, the lessening of a lot of these overall risk factors the patient can take control of their own way forward. And then from an RPE dysfunction, that I think has a lot to do with kind of the evidence that some of these dyslipidemias, they're laying down cholesterol, kind of these small cholesterol deposits at the layer of Bruch's. And I think that's inhibiting some of that vitamin A transport that's leading to some of that dark adaptation. So in my mind, the early maculopathy, those really mild to intermediate AMD patients, it's all about the microvascular insults and the RPE dysfunction.
All right, let's continue on this course then. So we're in a practice together and we have a lot of instrumentation at our disposal. We'll mention some of the ones that you've brought up already, as well as some additional ones. We have the instrument that measures dark adaptation, the ADAPT-DX on the market today. We have fundus autofluorescence at our disposal. We have OCTA, we have SD-OCT, and let's say we have fluorescein angiography. When are we going to most effectively employ all of these technologies at our disposal, and to which patients are we going to employ? For which patients are we going to pitch? Are we going to select which instrumentation?
So, you know, any patient that I see who has clinical signs of macular degeneration, I do go ahead and get an OCT and an FAF on that patient. And you may argue that that's not necessary if you see someone who has clinically early AMD, for example. You may not have to get an OCT, but I have the OCT in my practice. It's right there. It takes, you know, 1 minute to get these scans. And you really can get a lot of information from the OCT and from the fundus autofluorescence on these patients. So, for example, in some patients who clinically appear to have early or intermediate stage AMD, they may have findings like reticular pseudodrusen that mm-hmm. suggests they have increased risk for progression to advanced stages. And these patients may not appear with large size drusen. And so I think it's important to get that imaging to be able to look at the choroidal thickness. The fundus autofluoresce is nice because you can see sort of the either localized area of disease, or in some of these patients who clinically don't look that bad, they have actually really diffuse disease of the retinal pigment epithelium. So I get those on each patient, and I also get an OCT follow-up every single time I see the patient. And the reason for that is because you can see things on OCT that suggest potential conversion to exudative AMD that you may not be able to see clinically. And oftentimes you can make that diagnosis of conversion to exudative AMD based off of your OCT image alone. But if it's not clear, then you go to these other technologies like OCTA or fluorescein angiography.
Yeah, I don't think I could have said it better. I think the only thing is because we also have the ADAPT-DX at our disposal. It does have the CPT. I believe it's 92284, if I'm not mistaken. And a lot of the way that we will justify the billing for that is if the patient reports not nyctalopia necessarily, but difficulty with night vision. So mesopic difficulties, low light level difficulties. If I can essentially diagnose that, assess that in the chart, it justifies running of the ADAPT-DX. And really a lot of that literature, the 6.5 minute screen, if that patient cannot return to a normal sensitivity within 6.5 minutes, that is RPE dysfunction. There is a significant change going on in that retinal process. So usually if I have a patient who complains of that, I'll run the ADAPT-DX. And I absolutely love the spectral domain OCT because I think there's a lot of value, just like Jessica said, taking a look at those kind of major layers. And then when I really dig deep, I like to look at the ellipsoid zone. So really that ISOS junction. If I start to see some thinning, some kind of fading of that ellipsoid zone, that's really some areas of the mitochondrial powerhouse. So if I see some fading, I'm assuming there's some mitochondrial dysfunction within the retinal layers. And as Jessica pointed out, the RPE diffuse disease, if you start to see that RPE is allowing a little bit of hyper intensity below it, meaning it's a little brighter as that coherent light is passing through the RPE, it's not being reflected back. You can see that it's diffusely spreading through the RPE. You have a diseased RPE on your hands. And so, as we know, the RPE is the metabolic area for a lot of our retinal function. So if you have an RPE that's in danger, all of its support going up to the photoreceptors and beyond is also threatened. So I think moving forward, it's really all eyes on the RPE, pardon the pun, but fixing the RPE or doing your best to mitigate damage to the RPE level, I think is going to pay dividends for some of our mild and intermediate AMD patients.
All right, I got a question that's actually pretty meaningful to me, given the patient base that I commonly serve. But before I ask the question, you both have alluded to the fact that genetics, family history play a role in this disease function, and the statistics are actually pretty startling. I still believe that this is a multifactorial disease state. So take siblings, for example. Siblings tend to, more often than not, lead similar lifestyles, but brothers and sisters are different from one another. So it's certainly not universal, and they certainly aren't pattern matched. But that being said, there's a 3 to 6 times higher risk than for a sibling that has AMD to have the other sibling have it as well compared to the general population. So that's huge. So there's definitely some genetic play here in addition to common environmental habits and traits. The one thing that we cannot control besides age that we already talked about is our race. And I think that we would agree that Caucasians are very highly affected for this condition, followed by Hispanics and Asians, but I serve a very predominant African-American population who classically do not show the same common visual presentation of fundus retinopathy and dysfunction that a Caucasian patient with AMD has. So my question is it possible or plausible that an African-American can have some type of macular degeneration that just does not present in the same fashion that what we would consider traditional AMD presents as?
That's a really good question, Chris. And I think if you look up in patients who have AMD, what percentage of these patients would be considered, you know, African-American patients, and it may be like 3% or something. So, and you know, that's just per literature. And of course, who knows what their determination of who has AMD and who doesn't have AMD truly is. But to me, that means that, is it possible someone who is African-American could have macular degeneration? I think the answer is yes. But when diagnosing macular degeneration, you know, there's no one thing that says you have macular degeneration. Even the presence of drusen does not necessarily mean that you have what we truly think of as age-related macular degeneration. There are tons of macular degenerative conditions, macular dystrophies, and all of these things can masquerade as macular degeneration. So the way I sort of teach the students is in this manner. If you have a patient who doesn't fit a particular demographic, that should be sort of at least a stopping point. Or you say, okay, you know, this person is not the classic presentation of AMD. Do they truly have it? And then you have to go through your checkpoints of, you know, does their OCT show this? Does their OCT show that? Does their FAF look a certain way? And some of that is looking at, for example, the choroid. So patients who have AMD or who have true age-related macular degeneration tend to have a thinner than average choroid. So if your patient has a particularly thick choroid, you know, is this something else, essentially? In some ways, you know, macular degeneration, the diagnosis is based off the phenotypical presentation. And to some degree, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. You have drusen, you have RPE changes, you have pigmentary alterations, and it's not from something else. So, I mean, this is a bit of an extreme example, but we had a patient in our clinic a couple years ago who was an African-American female who had been diagnosed with age-related macular degeneration. And what she really had was plaquenil maculopathy. She had been taking plaquenil for years, and somebody had misdiagnosed her as having AMD. Obviously, these things don't look the same on OCT, FAF, but you know, if you look in the eye and you see pigmentary changes, maybe you have AMD. But if that physician had at least thought, hey, this lady isn't the typical patient to have AMD, perhaps they would have dug a little bit deeper, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it certainly does.
Yeah, and I think I think Jessica said everything perfectly. Exactly right. So using that spectral domain OCT and evaluating your choroidal thickness And I think that's a perfect starting point. And a lot of times too, if you're suspicious of a macular dystrophy, working in a university setting, we're fortunate to have electrodiagnostic testing. So a lot of times too, we can also help rule out potential dystrophies or toxic retinopathies by running an ERG, either a multifocal or a full field, just to get a sense of whether we have truly an AMD presentation or whether we have a greater dysfunction that would be more consistent with a dystrophy. So Jessica's exactly right. I think it's a diagnosis of exclusion at that point. If you have a presentation that looks like AMD, but you have it in a an individual that does not classically fit, you need to do the diagnosis of exclusion checklist and make sure that you're turning over every stone.
Okay, so let's dive into now the two disparate types of this disease state. And we'll start with dry AMD. And what are we to do with these patients? Are we to monitor? Are they to somehow monitor at a home? Are they still to use an Amsler grid? Given that, to my knowledge, dry AMD has no specific approved treatment. We have AREDS, we have AREDS 2. We have studies that have looked at intravitreal injections, low-dose oral doxy, mitochondrial protective compounds, stem cell therapy. Some of these are just in study phase. Some of these are actually in implementation phase. But what do we do for the masses of patients out there who, I guess for their fortune, aren't progressing to wet AMD, but still have some things going on in their eyes?
And Chris, if you want to take this one first, you can. I feel like I'm hogging it.
No, not at all. Yeah. So from a no maculopathy with high risk to a mild maculopathy to an intermediate maculopathy, I think Chris, you set me up perfectly. I think the AREDS 2 formulation, that's one of the greatest tools we have, right? It was a 5-year large patient number, large subject number, longitudinal study that showed that the addition of lutein and zeaxanthin to the high dose antioxidants did have some improvements in not only reduction of neovascular AMD, but also reduction to more the advanced stage of the non-exudative AMD. The AREDS 2, I think there's two big things that I always stress with the students is AREDS 2, I think, is sometimes inappropriately used in a clinical setting because AREDS 2 is clinically indicated in a patient who is moderate or intermediate AMD. So for your patients that have mild AMD or no maculopathy, it's really not clinically indicated. And some of the literature that it points to the fact that if you don't have those high-risk alleles that we talked about, CFH and ARMS2, if you don't have those high-risk alleles, utilizing AREDS2 formulations really provides very little to no benefit. So what I also like to stress on the AREDS2 is if you dig into how AREDS2 was set up, AREDS2, its control group, the standard of care was AREDS at the time. So essentially, when we see that the AREDS2, lutein and zeaxanthin with a reduction of zinc and the reduction of, or the substitution of beta carotene, I think because all of our controls were essentially given AREDS2 as a baseline, we kind of changed the floor, meaning we didn't have a true control because they were already on an AREDS formulation we knew was going to work. So I think sometimes the data has to be viewed from the standpoint that we already had a population that was healthier taking a supplement. So adding a little bit more, we weren't going to have the robust changes. So from a mild or a no maculopathy, I am a big believer in lutein and zeaxanthin. I think the xanthophyllic carotenoids absolutely have a role in their preferential deposition within the Henle fire layer and the photoreceptor axons. It not only has a potent antioxidant effect, it acts as a short wavelength, high energy filter. It's like a blue blocker for your photoreceptors because as it deposits, it's pre-receptoral. So every bit of incident light on your fovea, your foveola, it has to pass through the macular pigment. And macular pigment's absorption is around, say, 400 to about 480 with a peak at 460 nanometers. So you have an incredible absorptive property of a supplement that deposits in your retina. And additionally, I'd like to also add that omega-3s help with that deposition, and the emerging evidence on resveratrol and curcumin as a supplement to help at the RPE level. I think we need to start looking at the kind of treatment on high risk or mild maculopathy and really treat it like a sandwich. We're going to treat not only the sensory layers, but we want to treat that RPE layer as well and kind of give it the greatest chance to reduce the oxidative stress and reduce the overall inflammatory state at both of those locales.
So what's an example of what you may tell a patient to go home with?
And how
do you assuredly know they get the right stuff?
That's a great question. So I have a little handout that I give them. And so this handout, I will go. So I'm from San Antonio, or currently living in San Antonio. So the grocery store that we have in town is HEB. So I actually have bought some of the supplements from HEB. And from a nutraceutical standpoint, I'll just talk to the patient that, hey, you can look for the least expensive, but most important are whether they have those NSF, the CL, or the USP seals. And these are supplements, so they are not FDA regulated. They're only FTC regulated. But using one of the stamps, it does have some assurity that the amount of supplement contained in that pill is what it says it is. So what I'll usually recommend to them is lutein 20 milligrams and zeaxanthin 5 milligrams at least once a day. And then from an omega-3 standpoint, I think the literature really promotes kind of a DHA at 350 milligrams and EPA at 650 milligrams. So 1,000 milligrams of omega-3, but in that DHA to EPA ratio of essentially 1 to 2. And then resveratrol and curcumin, these are kind of newer players on the scene. But to me, all of the observable safe limits are at the 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams. So I'll typically recommend the 500 milligram of resveratrol once a day and the 500 milligrams of curcumin once a day, simply because that's the dosages the pills come in. And all of the literature that has human use studies, typically they're using between 250 twice a day to 500 milligrams once a day. So the literature is still supporting these dosages. So a lot of times my biggest pitch to the patient is the lutein and zeaxanthin that has clinically defined and has research backing that you will have some visual improvements in not only contrast sensitivity, but your glare reduction and photostress recovery. But the trick is you've got to use it for 3 months. You got to get them to 3 months just to have some noticeable improvement, and you got to get them to 6 months to have peak improvement. So why I like to give all four of those is because all four of those are working in synergy, but the patient will notice the improvements because of the lutein and zeaxanthin. And once you can show that patient that their visual quality has improved and they notice that, you suddenly have a patient that is all in on the nutraceuticals and they are reducing their risk factors over time. And those early modest changes to mild maculopathy, as Jessica alluded to at the beginning, small changes early in the disease pay big dividends 10, 12 years from now.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris. That was a very detailed response. Now, Jessica, let's dive into a more advanced condition. With wet AMD, we've gone through the years of laser photocoagulation, photodynamic therapy, and finally landed upon injectable anti-VEGF agents, where it seems to be we've been parking now for a number of years. How do you employ this? Who do you employ it to? When it comes to mind, first off, how do you broach the issue of needles and eyes mm-hmm. to patients who are going to basically have this for the rest of their lives? And then when I think of dosing, we have, options of fixed regimens where patients are very consistently coming in monthly or bimonthly. We obviously could have a PRN strategy, treat and extend, or observe and plan strategies. So how do you talk to a patient? How do you employ these? Which drug do you select? And how do you come up with a plan?
All great questions, Chris. So I do want to make one big point about anti-VEGF injections, no matter whether patients are getting off-label Avastin or they're getting this newest drug that came out, Beovu. These medications work best if the patient is detected early. So if the patient comes in with 20/200 vision, for example, you can treat that patient. But if they have significant subfoveal scarring, that patient's never going to get better than 20/200 vision. So all of these medications are going to work best if the patient is detected earlier. The better the visual acuity is at detection, the better visual outcomes these patients have. So we still have to be so diligent about educating our patients who have early intermediate AMD about monitoring their vision at home. And so your patients who have early AMD, I would definitely recommend some type of vision monitoring like an Amsler grid. But the patients who have intermediate AMD, there is actually an at-home device now that's approved, FDA approved by Notel Vision. called the 4C Home System that is essentially a prescription you give to the patient. You prescribe this device to the patient, the company sends it to them, and it's a little sort of machine that they do a test in every single day. If one eye is already advanced stage AMD, they can even use it in their fellow eye that's non-advanced stage. It's only approved for intermediate stage AMD. But it has been shown to detect conversion somewhat better than the Amsler grid. So one trial that was done that was supported by No-Tel Vision, but it's called the Home Study, showed that 62% of patients who were being monitored with traditional methods, so in office visits and Amsler grid testing, 62% were detected at 20/40 vision or better and when they converted to advanced stage AMD or to exudative AMD, versus about, I think, 97% who are using the 4C home system. So I've actually started in my patients who have intermediate stage AMD pretty much across the board recommending them to have this system. So again, no matter what anti-VEGF agent you use, if you can't catch this stuff early, we're sort of losing the game. I try to remember all the other questions that you asked. Yeah, so.
How do you bring up what's a kind of an intimidating topic from the patient's perspective, what they're going to be in for, and then how often do you plan its frequency? Do you keep everybody under the same structure or do you alter the structure?
Right. The initial visit with patients, a new patient who's being sent for, first visit for exudative AMD, that visit really is going to take a little bit longer than some of the other patients that I see. And some of that is patient education. So again, I have to spend a lot of time really talking to patients about the disease itself. Some of them come in very knowledgeable. Some of them don't. Some of them have never even heard about macular degeneration before this occurred, which is somewhat of an issue in and of itself. But that initial visit does require a lot of patient education because patients do not understand this concept of dry AMD versus wet AMD. They see these as two separate diseases. They hear these terms wet AMD and they think it has to do with their eyes watering. So there's a huge education that has to go on the front end about why they need this. It's also really, really important to tell this patient that this injection literally treats the fact that your retina is leaking or bleeding. It does not treat your macular degeneration. So we're not curing your macular degeneration, we're treating the wet aspect of it, and that this is not a one-time thing. So I tell patients from the very beginning that this is a medicine that we inject into the eye. After about a month, that medicine is gone and we may have to do this treatment again. Most patients we're going to treat same day that we see them and then see them a month later. The most common strategy for treating patients with exudative AMD is to treat monthly or every 4 weeks until there's no sign of either intraretinal or subretinal fluid, and then to extend their follow-up. So once you get complete drying of this lesion, you go from seeing them every 4 weeks to 5 weeks. If it's still dry, you stretch that out to 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks. This new medicine that's on the market, Beovu, 50% of patients who were in the clinical trial Archway were able to go every 3 months between injections. So as far as how long can a patient go in between injections, that's really highly variable. We have some people who are getting pretty much every month, and if they don't come in every month, they regress somewhat, and then we have other patients who are going much longer. As far as getting an injection in the eye, it is always hard to tell patients that, but I'll tell you this, our patients who have AMD, they are a tough group of people in general. And some of it may be because they are our more aged patients. They've had a lot of life experiences. They've dealt with a lot of things in their life. And some of them are not particularly fazed by getting injections. I think some of it too is because they have friends, family members who have received them. And so really this idea of getting injections in the eye may not necessarily be that foreign to them. You know, if they're talking with their friends or their family members, they may say, oh yes, well, my friend, she gets these too. So really, for most patients, they take the news fairly well. I would say better than my patients who have diabetic retinopathy in general. And AMD really, as far as injections, is a bit easier to convince patients of the need for, because they get these treatments, their vision, they notice the vision improvement. And if they do go AWOL for a little while and don't come back, they notice that their vision's getting worse. So that's very, very different than the patient with, for example, like proliferative retinopathy, who comes in and they have 20/20 vision. They don't think they have a problem. They get treated. They don't perceive a benefit to that. So most patients with AMD are really a lot more consistent with their follow-ups and a lot more receptive to having treatment, because of the fact that, you know, their vision was good, they noticed a change, and they want something to help. I think the other part of the question, what treatment option do you give patients? Unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with insurance coverage. I mean, that's probably the biggest limiting factor. We have these four drugs that are available. Avastin works very, very well for most patients who have AMD. And a lot of patients are getting Avastin because other things are not going to be covered by their insurance.
All right, I got two final questions for, I'd like both of you to weigh in on. Thank you for that, Jessica. I really hadn't thought about how a diabetic patient would approach an somewhat invasive procedure, given the fact that their vision oftentimes is so good at the beginning, versus a patient who really gets the nuts and bolts of the benefit of treatment and the problem when you delay treatment. So I that really does make a lot of sense. So the first question is, as I started a course back through the literature, there are actually more organized clinical trials on VEGF in particular for AMD than pretty much most disease states that we see in the eyes. There's just more than I can count. So my question is, what research might you predict will be coming our way in the next 1 to 3 years in regards to AMD?
So, you know, I really think the biggest thing that is most, the thing that's most likely to happen and be most advantageous to our patients are going to be these long-term delivery systems for anti-VEGF, because we have something that works very, very well for the condition, but is a huge burden to patients because of the fact that they have to come for visits so frequently. For example, they have this port delivery system that is being investigated now. In fact, I think it released its data in the summer sometime. It essentially has a modified version of Lucentis that is put into a port. This port has to be implanted into the eye surgically. And I think 98% of the patients who were in the clinical trial could go every 6 months to have this port refilled. So the rest of the time, you're just getting this continuous dose of Lucentis. So those types of treatments are probably really down the pike at some point, and that's going to make a huge difference for our patients as far as the burden of care. Unfortunately, I think we're still a ways off as far as treating geographic atrophy. That may, nothing at this point is quite as promising as these sort of long-acting delivery agents for anti-VEGF treatment.
Chris, any thoughts about what's coming next?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think the biggest barrier to treatment of a proliferative AMD is essentially just the frequency in which you have to have intraocular injections. And like any procedure, there's always an inherent risk. So there's always, the more injections you're giving, the greater that risk becomes. So I think the long-term delivery system that would diminish the amount of intravitreal injections, I think that will be the game changer going forward, at least in the near term.
Yeah.
Okay, last one. Go ahead, Jessica.
One more thing about these long-term delivery systems that I think is important for optometry too is, you know, if a patient can go every 6 months to the retina specialist and get this port refilled, that opens up an opportunity for us as well to monitor these patients in the interim. So to be able to have that patient come to your office perhaps every 2-3 months in between their refills to do an OCT, make sure they don't have any subretinal fluid. So this is a big potential opportunity for optometry.
Yep, makes perfect sense. So we've actually really done a almost 50-minute, relatively short, deep dive into this condition, which I tremendously appreciate. I respect you both. You certainly have a tremendous amount of knowledge and intellect in this condition. Give me a short few sentences on what you would say to somebody early in eye care practice who's likely going into an area in which AMD is prevalent and they're going to encounter this. how do you tell them not to be intimidated, to take the bull by the horns without fear of making mistakes, but actually capturing the right things and referring the right patients, et cetera? How do you make it simple for them to the best of your ability?
You know, Chris, I tell the students all the time, you guys have a ton of knowledge. They have a lot of experience now with diagnostic imaging, and they've seen a lot of things in clinic, pretty much that you know the basics, you know what you need to, you have this base knowledge to move forward and to treat these patients because you know how to look at OCTs, you know how to look at fundus autofluorescence, you know how to examine patients. So don't be afraid of these conditions. I think there is a little hesitancy for some physicians, especially early on when they see something funny on the OCT because they worry, you know, maybe this is a CMV. But also, you know, don't be afraid if you see something unusual to refer it out. Nobody is going to make fun of you for sending something out. You have to do what you think is in the best interest of your patient. And the more you see things and the more you take feedback and learn from the patients that you've encountered, then you can move forward. And maybe a patient that you saw a year ago that you were nervous about and referred out, now you feel comfortable. So I think all of us, when we look back at where we are in practice today, we compare that to where we were in practice, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. You think about, wow, you know, I did that 4 years ago. I wouldn't have done that today. So we're always growing. We're always learning. But you have the skills, you have the knowledge to really make a difference in these patients and a big difference in their visual outcomes.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I think the biggest thing that I work with the students at UIW and then the students that we also have as externs at Joint Base San Antonio Lackland, my biggest stress to them is I love algorithms. So I love to, we put together like a preferred practice guideline for them. And I like to stress to the student is run through a mock scenario in your head. You've got the algorithm. They present like this. What test are you going to run? If that test is positive for the finding you think, what are you going to do with it? If it's negative, do you want to run ancillary tests? And after a while, they get very comfortable with the use of these medical algorithms that help dictate what ancillary tests are needed and what are you going to do with that evidence. And I think for a new practitioner that's going to go into an area where, you know, they might be the sole eye care provider for many miles around. I think that is a ripe area of optometry development because as I think a lot of these projections going forward, there is going to be a dearth of surgical specialists going forward. I think neuro-ophthalmology has a significant undermanning issue right now. And I think as our population, as our demographic for AMD continues to increase, you're going to have less and less surgeons available to refer to. So I think number one is have an algorithm and be comfortable with that algorithm. How will you execute it if a patient presents with these symptoms and these signs? And then number two, know your referral network. When you get to a new area, make it a priority to go in and meet the surgeon. Go in and make yourself known to that practice. Even if it feels a little uncomfortable, just make yourself known to say, hey, my name, I'm, you know, Johnny Bag of Donuts, and I'm going to be practicing down the street. I'd love to just kind of get to know you a little better and have a good kind of working relationship where I can refer to you and I will be happy to provide the information that you would find most valuable in the conditional assessment. So I think algorithms and get to know your referral network is my two take-home points for that.
I could not agree more on what both of you said. Jessica, you definitely hit me with don't be afraid to ask, because I could tell you I've been practicing for a very long time and I ask for second opinions all of the time. Chris, your algorithm brought me back to the very beginnings of computer language with if and then statements.
Yes.
Where if this is happening, then do what? Confirm it, refute it, move on. It's very great advice. You two are brilliant optometrists. Thank you for spending time with us tonight. I will love to have you back on the podcast again. We're just under the hour, so thank you all for listening. And please send me a note if you have other topics that come to mind. Thank you and enjoy the rest of your day.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.